What's your name? Samuel asked pleasantly.
Lee. Got more name. Lee Papa family name. Call Lee.
I've read quite a lot about China. You born in China?
No, born here.
Samuel was silent for quite a long time while the buggy lurched down the wheel track toward the dusty valley. Lee, he said at last, I mean no disrespect, but I've never been able to figure out why you people still talk pidgin when an illiterate baboon from the black bogs of Ireland, with a head full of Gaelic and a tongue like a potato, learns to talk a poor grade of English in 10 years. Lee grinned.
Me talky Chinese talk, he said.
Well, I guess you have your reasons, and it's not my affair. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't believe it, Lee. Lee looked at him, and the brown eyes under their rounded upper lids seemed to open and deepen until they weren't foreign anymore, but man's eyes, warm with understanding. Lee chuckled.
It's more than a convenience, he said. It's even more than self-protection. Mostly we have to use it to be understood at all.
Samuel showed no sign of having observed any change. I can understand the first two, he said thoughtfully, but the third escapes me. Lee said,
I know it's hard to believe, but it has happened so often to me and to my friends that we take it for granted. If I should go up to a lady or a gentleman, for instance, and speak as I'm doing now, I wouldn't be understood.
Why not?
Pidgin they expect, and pidgin they'll listen to. But English from me they don't listen to, and so they don't understand it.
Can that be possible? How do I understand you?
That's why I'm talking to you. You are one of the rare people who can separate your observation from your preconception. You see what is, where most people see what they expect.
I hadn't thought of it. And I've not been so tested as you, but what you say has a candle of truth. You know, I'm very glad to talk to you. I've wanted to ask so many questions.
Happy to oblige.
So many questions. For instance, you wear the Q. I've read that it's a badge of slavery imposed by conquest by the Manchus on the southern Chinese.
That is true.
Then why in the name of God do you wear it here, where the Manchus can't get at you?
Talky Chinese talk. Q Chinese fashion.
You savvy?
Samuel laughed loudly. That does have the green touch of convenience, he said. I wish I had a hidey hole like that.
I'm wondering whether I can explain, said Lee. Where there is no likeness of experience, it is very difficult. I understand you were not born in America.
No, in Ireland.
And in a few years you can almost disappear, while I, who was born in Grass Valley, went to school and several years to the University of California, have no chance of mixing.
If you cut your cue, dressed and talk like other people?
No, I tried it. To the so-called whites, I was still a Chinese, but an untrustworthy one. And at the same time, my Chinese friends steered clear of me. I had to give it up.
Lee pulled up under a tree, got out, and unfastened the check rein.
Time for lunch, he said. I made a package. Would you like some?
Sure I would. Let me get down in the shade there. I forget to eat sometimes, and that's strange because I'm always hungry. I'm interested in what you say. It has a sweet sound of authority. Now it peeks into my mind that you should go back to China.
Lee smiled satirically at him.
In a few minutes, I don't think you'll find a loose bar I've missed in a lifetime of search. I did go back to China. My father was a fairly successful man. It didn't work. They said I looked like a foreign devil. They said I spoke like a foreign devil. I made mistakes in manners. And I didn't know delicacies that had grown up since my father left. They wouldn't have me. You can believe it or not, I'm less foreign here than I was in China.
I have to believe you because it's reasonable. You've given me things to think about until at least February 27th. Do you mind my questions?
As a matter of fact, no. The trouble with Pidgin is that you get to thinking in Pidgin. I write a great deal to keep my English up. Hearing and reading aren't the same as speaking and writing.
Don't you ever make a mistake? I mean, break into English?
No, I don't. I think it's a matter of what is expected. You look at a man's eyes, you see that he expects Pidgin and a shuffle, so you speak Pidgin and shuffle.
I guess that's right, said Samuel. In my own way, I tell jokes because people come all the way to my place to laugh. I try to be funny for them even when the sadness is on me.
But the Irish are said to be a happy people, full of jokes.
There's your Pidgin and your cue. They're not. They're a dark people, with a gift for suffering way past their deserving. It's said that without whiskey to soak and soften the world, they'd kill themselves. But they tell jokes because it's expected of them.
Lee unwrapped a little bottle. Would you like some of this?
Chinese drink inkapi.
What is it?
Chinese brandy. Strong drink.
As a matter of fact, it's a brandy with a dosage of wormwood. Very powerful. It softens the world.
Samuel sipped from the bottle. Tastes a little like rotten apples, he said.
Yes, but nice rotten apples. Tasted back along your tongue toward the roots.
Samuel took a big swallow and tilted his head back. I see what you mean. That is good.
Here are some sandwiches, pickles, cheese, a can of buttermilk.
You do well.
Yes, I see to it.
Samuel bit into a sandwich. I was shuffling over 50 questions. What you said brings the brightest one up. You don't mind?
Not at all. The only thing I do want to ask of you is not to talk this way when other people are listening. It would only confuse them, and they wouldn't believe it anyway.
I'll try, said Samuel. If I slip, just remember that I'm a comical genius. It's hard to split a man down the middle and always reach for the same half.
I think I can guess what your next question is.
What?
Why I'm content to be a servant.
How in the world did you know?
It seemed to follow.
Do you resent the question?
Not from you. There are no ugly questions except those clothed in condescension. I don't know where being a servant came into disrepute. It is the refuge of a philosopher, the food of the lazy, and properly carried out, it is a position of power, even of love. I can't understand why more intelligent people don't take it as a career. Learn to do it well and reap its benefits. A good servant has absolute security, not because of his master's kindness, but because of habit and indolence. It's a hard thing for a man to change spices or lay out his own socks. He'll keep a bad servant rather than change. But a good servant, and I am an excellent one, can completely control his master. Tell him what to think, how to act, whom to marry, when to divorce, reduce him to terror as a discipline, or distribute happiness to him, and finally be mentioned in his will. If I had wished, I could have robbed, stripped, and beaten anyone I've worked for and come away with thanks. Finally, in my circumstances, I am unprotected. My master will defend me and protect me. You have to work and worry. I work less and worry less. And I am a good servant. A bad one does no work and does no worrying, and he is still fed, clothed, and protected. I don't know any profession where the field is so cluttered with incompetence and where excellence is so rare.
Samuel leaned toward him, listening intently. Lee went on, It's going to be a relief after that to go back to Pidgin. It's a very short distance to the Sanchez place. Why did we stop so near? Samuel asked.
Only time talkie. Me Chinese number one boy. You let it go now?
What? Oh, sure. But it must be a lonely life.
That's the only fault with it, said Lee. I've been thinking of going to San Francisco and starting a little business.
Like a laundry or a grocery store?
No, too many Chinese laundries and restaurants. I thought perhaps a bookstore. I'd like that. and the competition wouldn't be too great. I probably won't do it, though. A servant loses his initiative.
This ends Disc 6. East of Eden, Disc 7.
In the afternoon, Samuel and Adam rode over the land. The wind came up as it did every afternoon, and the yellow dust ran into the sky.
"Oh, it's a good piece," Samuel cried. "It's a rare piece of land."
"Seems to me it's blowing away bit by bit," Adam observed.
"No, it's just moving over a little. You lose some to the James Ranch, but you get some from the Southies."
"Well, I don't like the wind. Makes me nervous."
"Nobody likes wind for very long. It makes animals nervous and restless, too. I don't know whether you noticed, but a little farther up the valley, they're planting windbreaks of gum trees. Eucalyptus comes from Australia. They say the gums grow 10 feet a year. Why don't you try a few rows and see what happens? In time, they should back up the wind a little, and they make grand firewood."
"Good idea," Adam said. "What I really want is water. This wind would pump all the water I could find. I thought if I could bring in a few wells and irrigate, the topsoil wouldn't blow away. I might try some beans."
Samuel squinted into the wind.
"I'll try to get you water if you want," he said. "And I've got a little pump I made that'll bring it up fast. It's my own invention. A windmill is a pretty costly thing. Maybe I could build them for you and save you some money."
"That's good," said Adam. "I wouldn't mind the wind if it worked for me. And if I could get water, I might plant alfalfa."
"It's never brought much of a price."
"I wasn't thinking of that. A few weeks ago, I took a drive up around Greenfield in Gonzales. Some Swiss have moved in there. They've got nice little dairy herds, and they get 4 crops of alfalfa a year."
"I heard about them. They brought in Swiss cows."
Adam's face was bright with plans.
"That's what I want to do. Sell butter and cheese and feed the milk to pigs."
"You're going to bring credit to the valley," Samuel said. "You're going to be a real joy to the future."
"If I can get water."
"I'll get you water if there's any to be got. I'll find it. I brought my magic wand."
He patted a forked stick tied to his saddle. Adam pointed to the left where a wide, flat place was covered with a low growth of sagebrush.
"Now then," he said, 36 acres and almost level as a floor. I put an auger down. Topsoil averages 3.5 feet, sand on top and loam within plow reach. Think you could get water there?"
"I don't know," Samuel said. "I'll see."
He dismounted, handed his reins to Adam, and untied his forked wand. He took the forks in his 2 hands and walked slowly, his arms out and stretched before him, and the wand tip up. His steps took a zigzag course. Once he frowned and backed up a few steps, then shook his head and went on. Adam rode slowly along behind, leading the other horse. Adam kept his eyes on the stick. He saw it quiver and then jerk a little, as though an invisible fish were tugging at a line. Samuel's face was taut with attention. He continued on until the point of the wand seemed to be pulled strongly downward against his straining arms. He made a slow circle, broke off a piece of sagebrush, and dropped it on the ground. He moved well outside his circle, held up his stick again, and moved inward toward his marker. As he came near it, the point of the stick was drawn down again. Samuel sighed and relaxed and dropped his wand on the ground.
"I can get water here," he said, "and not very deep. The pole was strong, plenty of water."
"Good," said Adam. "I want to show you a couple more places."
Samuel whittled out a stout piece of sagewood and drove it into the soil. He made a split on the top and fitted a crosspiece on for a mark. Then he kicked the brittle brush down in the area so he could find his marker again. On a second try, 300 yards away, the wand seemed nearly torn downward out of his hands.
"Now there's a whole world of water here," he said.
The third try wasn't so productive.
After half an hour, he had only the slightest sign. The two men rode slowly back toward the Trask house. The afternoon was golden, for the yellow dust in the sky gilded the light. As always, the wind began to drop as the day waned, but it sometimes took half the night for the dust to settle out of the air.
"I knew it was a good place," Samuel said. "Anyone can see that. But I didn't know it was that good. You must have a great drain under your land from the mountains. You know how to pick land, Mr. Trask."
Adam smiled. "We had a farm in Connecticut," he said. "For 6 generations, we dug stones out. One of the first things I remember is sledding stones over to the walls. I thought it was the way all farms were. It's strange to me, and almost sinful here. If you wanted a stone, you'd have to go a long way for it."
"The ways of sin are curious," Samuel observed. "I guess if a man had to shuck off everything he had, inside and out, he'd manage to hide a few little sins somewhere for his own discomfort. They're the last things we'll give up."
"Maybe that's a good thing to keep us humble, the fear of God in us."
"I guess so," said Samuel. "And I guess humility must be a good thing, since it's a rare man who hasn't a piece of it. But when you look at humbleness, it's hard to see where its value rests, unless you grant that it's a pleasurable pain and very precious. Suffering. I wonder if it has been properly looked at."
"Tell me about your stick," Adam said. "How does it work?"
Samuel stroked the fork, now tied to his saddle strings. "I don't really believe in it, save that it works." He smiled at Adam. "Maybe it's this way. Maybe I know where the water is, feel it in my skin. Some people have a gift in this direction or that. Suppose, well, call it humility or a deep disbelief in myself, force me to do a magic to bring up to the surface the thing I know anyway. Does that make any sense to you?"
"I'd have to think about it," said Adam.
The horses picked their own way, heads hung low, reins loosened against the bits.
"Can you stay the night?" Adam asked.
"I can, but better not. I didn't tell Liza I'd be away the night. I'd not like to give her a worry."
"But she knows where you are."
"Sure, she knows. But I'll ride home tonight. It doesn't matter the time. If you'd like to ask me to supper, I'd be glad."
"And when do you want me to start on the wells?"
"Now, as soon as you can. You know, it's no cheap thing, indulging yourself with water. I'd have to charge you 50 cents or more a foot, depending on what we find down there. It can run into money."
"I have the money. I want the wells. Look, Mr. Hamilton..."
"Samuel would be easier."
"Look, Samuel, I mean to make a garden of my land. Remember, my name is Adam. So far I've had no Eden, let alone been driven out."
"It's the best reason I ever heard for making a garden," Samuel exclaimed. He chuckled. "Where will the orchard be?"
Adam said, "I won't plant apples. That'd be looking for accidents."
"What does Eve say to that? She has a say, you remember, and Eve delights in apples."
"Not this one." Adam's eyes were shining. "You don't know this Eve. She'll celebrate my choice. I don't think anyone can know her goodness."
"You have a rarity. Right now, I can't recall any greater gift."
They were coming near the entrance to the little side valley in which was the Sanchez house. They could see the rounded green tops of the great live oaks.
"Gift," Adam said softly. "You can't know. No one can know. I had a gray life, Mr. Hamilton. Samuel. Not that it was bad compared to other lives, but it was nothing. I don't know why I tell you this."
"Maybe because I like to hear."
"My mother died before my memory. My stepmother was a good woman, but troubled and ill. My father was a stern, fine man, maybe a great man."
"You couldn't love him?"
"I had the kind of feeling you have in church, and not a little fear in it."
Samuel nodded.
"I know, and some men want that.
He smiled ruefully. I've always wanted the other. Liza says it's a weak thing in me. My father put me in the army, in the West, against the Indians. You told me. But you don't think like a military man. I wasn't a good one. I seem to be telling you everything. You must want to. There's always a reason. A soldier must want to do the things we had to do, or at least be satisfied with them. I couldn't find good enough reasons for killing men and women, nor understand the reasons when they were explained. They rode on in silence for a time. Adam went on. I came out of the army like dragging myself muddy out of a swamp. I wandered for a long time before going home to a remembered place I didn't love. Your father? He died. And home was a place to sit around or work around, waiting for death the way you might wait for a dreadful picnic. Alone? No, I have a brother. Where's he? Waiting for the picnic? Yes. Yes, that's exactly what. Then Kathy came. Maybe I'll tell you sometime when I can tell and you want to hear.
I want to hear, Samuel said. I eat stories like grapes.
A kind of light spread out from her, and everything changed color, and the world opened out, and a day was good to awaken to, and there were no limits to anything, and the people of the world were good and handsome, and I wasn't afraid anymore.
I recognize it, Samuel said. That's an old friend of mine. It never dies, but sometimes it moves away. Or you do. Yes, that's my acquaintance. Eyes, nose, mouth, and hair.
All this coming out of a little hurt girl.
And not out of you?
Oh, no. Or it would have come before. No, Kathy brought it. And it lives around her. And now I've told you why I want the Wells. I have to repay somehow for value received. I'm going to make a garden so good, so beautiful, that it will be a proper place for her to live and a fitting place for her light to shine on.
Samuel swallowed several times, and he spoke with a dry voice out of a pinched-up throat. I can see my duty, he said. I can see it plainly before me if I'm any kind of man, any kind of friend to you.
What do you mean?
Samuel said satirically, It's my duty to take this thing of yours and kick it in the face, then raise it up and spread slime on it thick enough to blot out its dangerous light. His voice grew strong with vehemence. I should hold it up to you muck-covered and show you its dirt and danger. I should warn you to look closer until you can see how ugly it really is. I should ask you to think of inconstancy and give you examples. I should give you Othello's handkerchief. Oh, I know I should. And I should straighten out your tangled thoughts, show you that the impulse is gray as lead and rotten as a dead cow in wet weather. If I did my duty well, I could give you back your bad old life and feel good about it, and welcome you back to the musty membership in the lodge.
Are you joking? Maybe I shouldn't have told him.
It is the duty of a friend. I had a friend who did the duty once for me. But I'm a false friend. I'll get no credit for it among my peers. It's a lovely thing. Preserve it and glory in it. And I'll dig your wells if I have to drive my rig to the black center of the earth. I'll squeeze water out like juice from an orange. They rode under the great oaks and toward the house. Adam said,
There she is, sitting outside.
He shouted,
Kathy, he says there's water, lots of it.
Aside, he asked excitedly,
Did you know she's going to have a baby?
Even at this distance, she looks beautiful, Samuel said. Because the day had been hot, Lee set a table outside under an oak tree.
and as the sun neared the western mountains, he padded back and forth from the kitchen, carrying the cold meats, pickles, potato salad, coconut cake, and peach pie, which were supper. In the center of the table, he placed a gigantic stoneware pitcher full of milk. Adam and Samuel came from the washhouse, their hair and faces shining with water, and Samuel's beard was fluffy after its soaping. They stood at the trestle table and waited until Kathy came out. She walked slowly, picking her way as though she were afraid she would fall. Her full skirt and apron concealed to a certain extent her swelling abdomen. Her face was untroubled and childlike, and she clasped her hands in front of her. She had reached the table before she looked up and glanced from Samuel to Adam. Adam held her chair for her. "You haven't met Mr. Hamilton, dear," he said. She held out her hand. "How do you do?" she said. Samuel had been inspecting her. "It's a beautiful face," he said. "I'm glad to meet you. You're well, I hope."
"Oh, yes. Yes, I'm well."
The men sat down. "She makes it formal whether she wants to or not. Every meal is a kind of occasion," Adam said.
"Don't talk like that," she said. "It isn't true."
"Doesn't it feel like a party to you, Samuel?" he asked. "It does so. And I can tell you there's never been such a candidate for a party as I am. And my children, they're worse. My boy Tom wanted to come today. He's spoiling to get off the ranch." Samuel suddenly realized that he was making his speech last to prevent silence from falling on the table. He paused, and the silence dropped. Kathy looked down at her plate while she ate a sliver of roast lamb. She looked up as she put it between her small, sharp teeth. Her wide-set eyes communicated nothing. Samuel shivered.
"It isn't cold, is it?" Adam asked.
"Cold? No. A goose walked over my grave, I guess."
"Oh, yes, I know that feeling."
The silence fell again. Samuel waited for some speech to start up, knowing in advance that it wouldn't. "Do you like our valley, Mrs. Trask?"
"What? Oh, yes."
"If it isn't impertinent to ask, when is your baby due?"
"In about 6 weeks," Adam said. "My wife is one of those paragons, a woman who doesn't talk very much."
"Sometimes a silence tells the most," said Samuel. And he saw Kathy's eyes leap up and down again. And it seemed to him that the scar on her forehead grew darker. Something had flicked her, the way you'd flick a horse with the braided string popper on a buggy whip. Samuel couldn't recall what he had said that had made her give a small inward start. He felt a tenseness coming over him that was somewhat like the feeling he had just before the water wand pulled down, an awareness of something strange and strained. He glanced at Adam and saw that he was looking raptly at his wife. Whatever was not strange to Adam. His face had happiness on it. Kathy was chewing a piece of meat, chewing with her front teeth. Samuel had never seen anyone chew that way before. And when she had swallowed, her little tongue flicked around her lips. Samuel's mind repeated, "Something, something. Can't find what it is. Something wrong." And the silence hung on the table. There was a shuffle behind him. He turned. Lee set a teapot on the table and shuffled away. Samuel began to talk, to push the silence away. He told how he had first come to the valley fresh from Ireland, but within a few words neither Kathy nor Adam was listening to him. To prove it, he used a trick he had devised to discover whether his children were listening when they begged him to read to them and wouldn't let him stop. He threw in two sentences of nonsense. There was no response from either Adam or Kathy. He gave up. He bolted his supper, drank his tea scalding hot, and folded his napkin. "Ma'am, if you'll excuse me, I'll ride off home, and I thank you for your hospitality."
"Good night," she said.
Adam jumped to his feet. He seemed torn out of a reverie.
"Don't go now. I hoped to persuade you to stay the night."
No, thank you, but that I can't. And it's not a long ride. I think, of course, I know there'll be a moon.
When will you start the wells?
I'll have to get my rig together, do a piece of sharpening, and put my house in order. In a few days, I'll send the equipment with Tom.
The life was flowing back into Adam. Make it soon, he said. I want it soon. Kathy, we're going to make the most beautiful place in the world. There'll be nothing like it anywhere.
Samuel switched his gaze to Kathy's face. It didn't change. The eyes were flat, and the mouth with its small upcurve at the corners was carven.
That will be nice, she said.
For just a moment, Samuel had an impulse to do or say something to shock her out of her distance. He shivered again.
Another goose? Adam asked.
Another goose. The dusk was falling, and already the tree forms were dark against the sky. Good night, then.
I'll walk down with you.
No, stay with your wife. You haven't finished your supper.
But I...
Sit down, man. I can find my own horse. And if I can't, I'll steal one of yours. Samuel pushed Adam gently down in his chair. Good night. Good night. Good night, ma'am. He walked quickly toward the shed. Old Platterfoot Doxology was daintily nibbling hay from the manger with lips like two flounders. The halter chain clinked against wood. Samuel lifted down his saddle from the big nail where it hung by one wooden stirrup and swung it over the broad back. He was lacing the latigo through the cinch rings when there was a small stir behind him. He turned and saw the silhouette of Lee against the last light from the open shadows.
When you come back? The Chinese asked softly.
I don't know. In a few days or a week? Lee, what is it?
What is what?
By God, I got creepy. Is there something wrong here?
What do you mean?
You know damn well what I mean.
Chinese boy just worky. Not here, not talky.
Yes, I guess you're right.
Sure, you're right.
Sorry I asked you. It wasn't very good manners.
He turned back, slipped the bit in Doc's mouth, and laced the big flop ears into the headstall. He slipped the halter and dropped it in the manger.
Good night, Lee, he said.
Mr. Hamilton?
Yes.
Do you need a cook?
On my place, I can't afford a cook.
I'd work cheap.
Liza would kill you. Why you want to quit?
Just thought I'd ask, said Lee. Good night.
Adam and Kathy sat in the gathering dark under the tree.
He's a good man, Adam said. I like him. I wish I could persuade him to take over here and run this place. Kind of a superintendent.
Kathy said, he's got his own place and his own family.
Yes, I know. And it's the poorest land you ever saw. He could make more at wages from me. I'll ask him.
It does take a time to get used to a new country. It's like being born again and having to learn all over. I used to know from what quarter the rains came. It's different here. And once I knew in my skin whether wind would blow, whether it'd be cold. But I'll learn. It just takes a little time. Are you comfortable, Kathy?
Yes.
One day, and not too far away, you'll see the whole valley green with alfalfa. See it from the fine big windows of the finished house. I'll plant rows of gum trees, and I'm going to send away for seeds and plants. Put in a kind of experimental farm. I might try lychee nuts from China. I wonder if they would grow here. Well, I can try. Maybe Lee could tell me. And once the baby's born, you can ride over the whole place with me. You haven't really seen it. Did I tell you? Mr. Hamilton is going to put up windmills, and we'll be able to see them turning from here.
He stretched his legs out comfortably under the table.
Lee should bring candles, he said. I wonder what's keeping him.
Kathy spoke very quietly.
Adam, I didn't want to come here. I'm not going to stay here. As soon as I can, I will go away.
Oh, nonsense! He laughed. You're like a child away from home for the first time. You'll love it once you get used to it, and the baby is born. You know, when I first went away to the army, I thought I was going to die of homesickness. But I got over it. We all get over it. Don't say silly things like that.
It's not a silly thing. Don't talk about it, dear. Everything will change after the baby is born. You'll see. You'll see.
He clapped his hands behind his head and looked up at the faint stars through the tree branches. Chapter 16. Samuel Hamilton rode back home in a night so flooded with moonlight that the hills took on the quality of the white and dusty moon. The trees and earth were moon dry, silent and airless and dead. The shadows were black without shading, and the open places white without color. Here and there Samuel could see secret movement, for the moon feeders were at work. The deer which browse all night when the moon is clear and sleep under thickets in the day. Rabbits and field mice and all other small hunted that feel safer in the concealing light crept and hopped and crawled and froze to resemble stones or small bushes when ear or nose suspected danger. The predators were working too. The long weasels like waves of brown light. The cobby wildcats crouching near to the ground, almost invisible except when their yellow eyes caught light and flashed for a second. The foxes, sniffling with pointed, upraised noses for a warm-blooded supper. The raccoons padding near still water, talking frogs. The coyotes nuzzled along the slopes and, torn with sorrow, joy, raised their heads and shouted their feeling, half keen, half laughter at their goddess moon. And over all, the shadowy screech owl sailed, drawing a smudge of shadowy fear below them on the ground. The wind of the afternoon was gone, and only a little breeze like a sigh was stirred by the restless thermals of the warm, dry hills. Doxology's loud, offbeat hoofsteps silenced the night people until after he had passed. Samuel's beard glinted white, and his graying hair stood up high on his head. He had hung his black hat on his saddle horn. An ache was on the top of his stomach, an apprehension that was like a sick thought. It was a Welshmerz, which we used to call Welsh rats, the world sadness that rises into the soul like a gas and spreads despair, so that you probe for the offending event and can find none. Samuel went back in his mind over the fine ranch and the indications of water. No Welsh rats could come out of that unless he sheltered a submerged envy. He looked in himself for envy and could find none. He went on to Adam's dream of a garden like Eden and to Adam's adoration of Kathy. Nothing there, unless his secret mind brooded over his own healed loss. But that was so long ago he had forgotten the pain. The memory was mellow and warm and comfortable now that it was all over. His loins and his thighs had forgotten hunger. As he rode through the light and dark of tree shade and open, his mind moved on. When had the Welsh rats started crawling in his chest? He found it then. And it was Kathy. Pretty, tiny, delicate Kathy. But what about her? She was silent, but many women were silent. What was it? Where had it come from? He remembered that he had felt an imminence akin to the one that came to him when he held the water wand. He remembered the shivers when the goose walked over his grave. Now he had pinned it down in time and place and person. It had come at dinner, and it had come from Kathy. He built her face in front of him and studied her wide-set eyes, delicate nostrils, mouth smaller than he liked, but sweet,
small, firm chin, and back to her eyes. Were they cold? Was it her eyes? Was he circling to the point? The eyes of Kathy had no message, no communication of any kind. There was nothing recognizable behind them. They were not human eyes. They reminded him of something. What was it? Some memory, some picture. He strove to find it, and then it came of itself. It rose out of the years, complete with all its colors and its cries, its crowded feelings. He saw himself a very little boy, so small that he had to reach high for his father's hand. He felt the cobbles of Londonderry under his feet and the crush and gaiety of the one big city he had seen. A fair it was, with puppet shows and stalls of produce and horses and sheep penned right in the street for sale or trade or auction, and other stalls of bright-colored knick-knackery, desirable, and because his father was gay, almost possessible. And then the people turned like a strong river, and they were carried along a narrow street as though they were chips on a flood tide, pressure at chest and back and the feet keeping up. The narrow street opened out to a square, and against the gray wall of a building there was a high structure of timbers and a noosed rope hanging down. Samuel and his father were pushed and bunted by the water of people, pushed closer and closer. He could hear in his memory ear his father saying, "It's no thing for a child. It's no thing for anybody, but less for a child." His father struggled to turn, to force his way back against the flood wave of people. "Let us out, please, let us out. I've a child here." The wave was faceless, and it pushed without passion. Samuel raised his head to look at the structure. A group of dark-clothed, dark-headed men had climbed up on the high platform, and in their midst was a man with golden hair, dressed in dark trousers and a light blue shirt, open at the throat. Samuel and his father were so close that the boy had to raise his head high to see. The golden man seemed to have no arms. He looked out over the crowd and then looked down, looked right at Samuel. The picture was clear, lighted, and perfect. The man's eyes had no depth. They were not like other eyes, not like the eyes of a man. Suddenly there was a quick movement on the platform, and Samuel's father put both his hands on the boy's head so that his palms cupped over the ears and his fingers met behind. The hands forced Samuel's head down and forced his face tight in against his father's black best coat. Struggle as he would, he couldn't move his head. He could see only a band of light around the edge of his eyes, and only a muffled roar of sound came to his ears through his father's hands. He heard heartbeats in his ears. Then he felt his father's hands and arms grow rigid with set muscles, and against his face he could feel his father's deep-caught breathing, and then deep intake and held breath, and his father's hands trembling. A little more there was to it, and he dug it up and set it before his eyes in the air ahead of the horse's head. A worn and battered table at a pub, loud talk and laughter. A pewter mug was in front of his father, and a cup of hot milk, sweet and aromatic with sugar and cinnamon, before himself. His father's lips were curiously blue, and there were tears in his father's eyes. "I'd never have brought you if I'd known. It's not fit for any man to see, and sure not for a small boy."
"I didn't see any," Samuel piped. "You held my head down."
"I'm glad of that."
"What was it?"
"I'll have to tell you. They were killing a bad man."
"Was it the golden man?"
"Yes, it was. And you must put no sorrow on him. He had to be killed. Not once, but many times he did dreadful things. Things only a fiend could think of. It's not his hanging sorrows me, but that they make a holiday of it that should be done secretly, in the dark."
"I saw the golden man. He looked right down at me."
"For that even more, I thank God he's gone."
"What did he do?"
"I'll never tell you nightmare things." He had the strangest eyes, the golden man. They put me in mind of a goat's eyes.
Drink your sweetie milk, and you shall have a stick with ribbons and a long whistle like silver.
And the shiny box with a picture into it?
That also. So you drink up your sweetie milk and beg no more.
And there it was, mined out of the dusty past. Doxology was climbing the last rise before the hollow of the home ranch, and the big feet stumbled over stones in the roadway. It was the eyes, of course, Samuel thought. Only twice in my life have I seen eyes like that, not like human eyes. And he thought, it's the night and the moon. Now what connection under heaven can there be between the golden man, hanged so long ago, and the sweet little bearing mother? Liza's right. My imagination will get me a passport to hell one day. Let me dig this nonsense out, else I'll be searching that poor child for evil. This is how we can get trapped. Now think hard and then lose it. Some accident of eye shape and eye color it is. But no, that's not it. It's a look, and has no reference to shape or color. Well, why is a look evil, then? Maybe such a look may have been sometime on a holy face. Now stop this romancing, and never let it trouble again, ever. He shivered. I'll have to set up a goose fence around my grave, he thought. And Samuel Hamilton resolved to help greatly with the Salinas Valley Eden, to make a secret guilt payment for his ugly thoughts. Liza Hamilton, her apple cheeks flaming red, moved like a caged leopard in front of the stove when Samuel came into the kitchen in the morning. The oakwood fire roared up past an open damper to heat the oven for the bread, which lay white and rising in the pans. Liza had been up before dawn. She always was. It was just as sinful to her to lie abed after light as it was to be abroad after dark. There was no possible virtue in either. Only one person in the world could, with impunity and without crime, lie between her crisp iron sheets after dawn, after sunup, even to the far reaches of mid-morning, and that was her youngest, the last-born, Joe. Only Tom and Joe lived on the ranch now, and Tom, big and red, already cultivating a fine, flowing mustache, sat at the kitchen table with his sleeves rolled down as he had been mannered. Liza poured thick batter from a pitcher onto a soapstone griddle. The hot cakes rose like little hassocks, and small volcanoes formed and erupted on them until they were ready to be turned. A cheerful brown they were, with tracings of darker brown, and the kitchen was full of the good, sweet smell of them. Samuel came in from the yard where he had been washing himself. His face and beard gleamed with water, and he turned down the sleeves of his blue shirt as he entered the kitchen. Rolled-up sleeves at the table were not acceptable to Mrs. Hamilton. They indicated either an ignorance or a flouting of the niceties. "I'm late, Mother," Samuel said. She didn't look around at him. Her spatula moved like a striking snake, and the hotcakes settled their white sides hissing on the soapstone. "What time was it you came home?" she asked. "Oh, it was late, late. Must have been near 11. I didn't look, fearing to waken you." "I did not waken," Liza said grimly. "And maybe you can find it healthy to rove all night, but the Lord God will do what he sees fit about that." It was well known that Liza Hamilton and the Lord God held similar convictions on nearly every subject. She turned and reached, and a plate of crisp hotcakes lay between Tom's hands. "How does the Sanchez place look?" she asked. Samuel went to his wife, leaned down from his great height, and kissed her round red cheek. "Good morning, Mother. Give me your blessing." "Bless you," said Liza automatically. Samuel sat down at the table and said, "Bless you, Tom. Well, Mr. Trask is making great changes. He's fitting up the old house to live in." Liza turned sharply from the stove. "The one where the cows and pigs have slept the years?"
Oh, he's ripped out the floors and window casings, all new and all painted. He'll never get the smell of pigs out, Liza said firmly. There's a pungency left by a pig that nothing can wash out or cover up.
Well, I went inside and looked around, Mother, and I could smell nothing except paint.
When the paint dries, you'll smell pig, she said.
He's got a garden laid out with spring water running through it. And he's set a place apart for flowers, roses and the like. And some of the bushes are coming clear from Boston.
I don't see how the Lord God puts up with such waste, she said grimly. Not that I don't like a rose myself.
He said he'd try to root some cuttings for me, Samuel said.
Tom finished his hotcakes and stirred his coffee.
What kind of man is he, Father?
Well, I think he's a fine man. Has a good tongue and a fair mind. He's given to dreaming.
Hear now the pot blaggarding the kettle, Liza interrupted.
I know, Mother, I know. But have you ever thought that my dreaming takes the place of something I haven't? Mr. Trask has practical dreams, and the sweet dollars to make them solid. He wants to make a garden of his land, and he will do it, too.
What's his wife like? Liza asked.
Well, she's very young and very pretty. She's quiet, hardly speaks, but then she's having her first baby soon.
I know that, Liza said. What was her name before?
I don't know.
Well, where did she come from?
I don't know.
She put his plate of hotcakes in front of him and poured coffee in his cup and refilled Tom's cup.
What did you learn then? How does she dress?
Why, very nice. Pretty. A blue dress and a little coat. Pink, but tight about the waist.
You've an eye for that. Would you say they were made clothes or store-bought?
No, I think store-bought.
You would not know, Liza said firmly. You thought the traveling suit Desi made to go to San Jose was store-bought.
Desi's the clever love, said Samuel. A needle sings in her hands.
Tom said, Desi's thinking of opening a dressmaking shop in Salinas.
She told me, Samuel said. She'd make a great success of it.
Salinas?
Liza put her hands on her hips.
Desi didn't tell me.
I'm afraid we've done bad service to our dearie, Samuel said. Here she wanted to save it for a real tin-plate surprise to her mother, and we've leaked it, like wheat from a mousehole sack.
She might have told me, said Liza. I don't like surprises. Well, go on. What was she doing?
Who?
Why, Mrs. Trask, of course.
Doing? Why, sitting. Sitting in a chair under an oak tree. Her time's not far.
Her hands, Samuel, her hands. What was she doing with her hands?
Samuel searched his memory.
Nothing, I guess. I remember she had little hands, and she held them clasped in her lap.
Liza sniffed.
Not sewing, not mending, not knitting?
No, Mother.
I don't know that it's a good idea for you to go over there. Riches and idleness, devil's tools. And you've not a very sturdy resistance.
Samuel raised his head and laughed with pleasure. Sometimes his wife delighted him, but he could never tell her how.
It's only the riches I'll be going there for, Liza.
I meant to tell you after breakfast so you could sit down to hear. He wants me to bore 4 or 5 wells for him, and maybe put windmills in storage tanks.
Is it all talk? Is it a windmill turn by water? Will he pay you? Or will you come back excusing as usual? He'll pay when his crop comes in, she mimicked. He'll pay when his rich uncle dies. It's my experience, Samuel, and it should be yours, that if they don't pay presently, they never pay at all. We could buy a valley farm with your promises.
Adam Trask will pay, said Samuel. He's well fixed. His father left him a fortune. It's a whole winter of work, Mother. We'll lay something by, and we'll have a Christmas to scrape the stars.
He'll pay 50 cents a foot, and the windmills, Mother. I can make everything but the casings right here. I'll need the boys to help. I want to take Tom and Joe.
Joe can't go, she said. You know he's delicate.
I thought I might scrape off some of his delicacy. He can starve on delicacy.
Joe can't go, she said finally. And who is to run the ranch while you and Tom are gone?
I thought I'd ask George to come back. He doesn't like a clerk's job, even if it is in King City.
Like it he may not, but he can take a measure of discomfort for $8 a week.
Mother, Samuel cried, here's our chance to scratch our name in the First National Bank. Don't throw the weight of your tongue in the path of fortune, please, Mother.
She grumbled to herself all morning over her work, while Tom and Samuel went over the boring equipment, sharpened bits, drew sketches of windmills new in design, and measured for timbers and redwood water tanks. In the mid-morning, Joe came out to join them, and he became so fascinated that he asked Samuel to let him go. Samuel said,
"Offhand, I'd say I'm against it, Joe. Your mother needs you here."
"But I want to go, Father. And don't forget, next year I'll be going to college in Palo Alto, and that's going away, isn't it? Please let me go. I'll work hard."
"I'm sure you would if you could come, but I'm against it. And when you talk to your mother about it, I'll thank you to let it slip that I'm against it. You might even throw in that I refused you."
Joe grinned and Tom laughed aloud.
"Will you let her persuade you?" Tom asked.
Samuel scowled at his sons.
"I'm a hard opinion man," he said. "Once I've set my mind, oxen can't stir me. I've looked at it from all angles, and my word is, Joe can't go. You wouldn't want to make a liar of my word, would you?"
"I'll go in and talk to her now," said Joe.
"Now, son, take it easy," Samuel called after him. "Use your head. Let her do most of it. Meanwhile, I'll set my stubborn up."
2 days later, the big wagon pulled away, loaded with timbers and tackle. Tom drove 4 horses, and beside him Samuel and Joe sat swinging their feet. Chapter 17. When I said Kathy was a monster, it seemed to me that it was so. Now I have bent close with a glass over the small print of her and reread the footnotes, and I wonder if it was true. The trouble is that since we cannot know what she wanted, we will never know whether or not she got it. If, rather than running toward something, she ran away from something, we can't know whether she escaped. Who knows but that she tried to tell someone or everyone what she was like and couldn't, for lack of a common language. Her life may have been her language, formal, developed, indecipherable. And it is easy to say she was bad, but there is little meaning unless we know why. I've built the image in my mind of Kathy, sitting quietly, waiting for her pregnancy to be over, living on a farm she didn't like, with a man she didn't love. She sat in her chair under the oak tree, her hands clasped each to each in love and shelter. She grew very big, abnormally big, even at a time when women gloried in big babies and counted extra pounds with pride. She was misshapen. Her belly, tight and heavy and distended, made it impossible for her to stand without supporting herself with her hands. But the great lump was local. Shoulders, neck, arms, hands, face were unaffected, slender and girlish. Her breasts didn't grow, and her nipples didn't darken. There was no quickening of milk glands, no physical planning to feed the newborn. When she sat behind a table, you couldn't see that she was pregnant at all. In that day, there was no measuring of pelvic arch, no testing of blood, no building with calcium. A woman gave a tooth for a child. It was the law. And a woman was likely to have strange tastes, some said for filth. And it was set down to the Eve nature, still under sentence for original sin. Kathy's odd appetite was simple compared to some.
The carpenters, repairing the old house, complained that they couldn't keep the lumps of chalk with which they coated their chalk lines. Again and again,